Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guests today are three philosophy professors who collaborated on a book about the Coen brothers' movie, The Big Lebowski. Assistant Professor Robert Jones of California State University, Chico, and his colleague Professor Troy Jollimore wrote one of the 19 essays in the book, The Big Lebowski and Philosophy, Keeping Your Mind Limber with Abiding Wisdom. Welcome, gentlemen. Another contributor, who is also the editor of the collection, is Peter Fossil. He's a professor of philosophy and chair of the philosophy department at Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky. Professor Fossil is a summa cum laude graduate of Bucknell University with BA degrees in philosophy and economics. He was a Fulbright student at the University of Edinburgh and received a PhD in philosophy from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He is author or editor of six books, including The Big Lebowski and Philosophy. Welcome, Peter Fossil.
It's great to be here, Nancy. Thank you.
Well, whose idea was this?
Well, it came about in a conversation between me and Bill Irwin, who's the series editor. Bill has really done a great job.
So in other words, you can explain there's a series of these books. You might explain.
Yeah. Bill's a professor at King's College in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I got to know him. Actually, I don't know how I got to know him. I think it was through the Philosopher's Magazine. He used to be a contributor to this magazine called the Philosopher's Magazine. And we shared some interests. And Bill has been really great in organizing this series of sort of philosophy and books. I mean, there's philosophy in Seinfeld, philosophy in The Simpsons, philosophy in Star Trek, philosophy in The Matrix. In fact, the philosophy of Matrix became a bestseller. And it was a real surprise that Americans just took to these books. If you go to Europe and travel around on the metro or the tube or something like that, you'll see people reading philosophy. Britain has, I think, at one point, I'm not sure right now, but it had something like six just newsstand philosophy magazines, about a third of our population, whereas the U.S. had none. But then, you know, in the U.S., it seemed that people started buying philosophy books that were somehow connected to pop culture. Americans found that philosophy was interesting if you fed it to them through the lenses of pop culture. And this series has been really successful, and it's, I don't know, there's dozens of books in it now. And anyway, he and I started talking, and he knew I had an interest in The Big Lebowski, and we batted around the idea. And it was an odd one because usually these texts come out in a timely way. So there's a philosophy in The Hobbit, for instance, coming out because the film is coming out. And
this movie was 1998.
Exactly. But a strange thing about this movie was it was sort of a flop at the box office. I mean, a lot of Coen Brothers movies, as you know, real successes. But and this came on the heels of a very successful movie for them. I forget what – I think it was Fargo. It came right after Fargo. But people didn't like it at first. But it's grown over time. So that I'm told now – The Big Lebowski is the second most popular cult movie in the United States after Rocky Horror. And it's somehow, I don't know if history has changed, the culture has changed, but people are really taking to The Big Lebowski now.
Well, you know what? I mentioned to a friend of mine that I know is interested in this sort of thing, and I asked him if he'd seen the movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember whether he said he had, but he knew it had become a cult classic.
Yeah.
And he said that The Matrix also, he said there's wonderful philosophy in The Matrix, but mm-hmm. his wife, who teaches literature, he said she couldn't get past the science fiction element of it.
Yeah.
But he was quite impressed with the philosophy in The Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
So you, in this series, you and the editor of the whole series, mm-hmm. take topics that people would have an interest in
mm-hmm.
and talk about the philosophy in it. Now, you mentioned something like that in your introduction to the book.
That's right.
That you take something from pop culture. You want to read a little bit of your introduction there of the book?
Sure. Just tell me if I go on too long with it. Pull this up. Oops. Here we go. What makes a book or a film philosophical? Is it being prepared to argue arcane conceptual minutiae, whatever the cost, no matter how many people it bores? Is that what makes a philosophical text? The editors and contributors to this volume are committed to the idea that topics of philosophical interest can be found just about anywhere. sure, in ancient Athens and contemporary universities, but also in homes and in bars, on iPods and in movie theaters. When it comes to questions of truth, goodness, beauty, reality, and meaning, frankly, it's hard to find a time and place they don't apply. To some extent, the ubiquity of philosophical considerations in life is both philosophy's strength and its weakness. Because matters of philosophical interest are everywhere and involve pretty much everyone, it often seems as if anything goes in philosophy. It seems just as right to say to philosophers about their output what the dude aptly tells the Jesus in the film, well, that's just your opinion, man. Yet then again, just as not everyone who picks up a bowling ball is a golfer, not just anything a bunch of bums might say or do at a bowling alley can count as philosophy. Of course, I can't say I've seen London. These are allusions to the movie, Nancy. Mm-hmm. Recently. And I ain't been to France as often as I'd like. But it seems to me that thinking philosophically is about something, even a movie, means at least thinking carefully about it. Means thinking about how it fits in or doesn't fit right in with established philosophical theories and principles. Not every child who wanders into the middle of a movie can achieve that kind of thinking. The essays in this volume, however, even those that might sometimes seem stupefying, really do.
Well, now, people who have seen the movie will recognize these lines from the script in the movie.
In fact, we sort of, had authors, as they wrote their text, to try to, fill in allusions and idioms and references to the film, as much as possible, so that as you read the text, it's not just dry philosophical sort of things, but it's peppered and made kind of funny and interesting, and engaging for readers, I think, because it's full of this kind of, idiom.
And that's where the next two guests come in. Robert Jones received a PhD in philosophy from Stanford University. His research includes food ethics, environmental ethics, mind and cognition, species studies, and the question of what it is to be human. He has given talks at Stanford, Yale, Wesleyan, UCLA, and the University of Auckland. He joined the faculty at California State University, Chico, in 2008. So, Robert Jones, when did you come in on this project?
Well, an email went out as an announcement. Philosophers have email lists, among other things, but we get these lists of various calls for papers. And so an email appeared in my inbox, and it said it was soliciting essays for The Big Lebowski in Philosophy. And I immediately got the email and forwarded it to my colleague, Troy Jollimore, because we have discussions about film, and we love the Coen brothers and The Big Lebowski. And I think he had simultaneously gotten an email in his box and sent it to me saying, we have to write an essay.
So, as I recall, we were actually talking about the film the night before. Literally, we got the email. So it sort of felt like it was meant to be. And
that's true.
As if Peter somehow, in his intuitive mind, grasped that we were out there and ready, and this was the moment to reach out for us. Of course, the email went to many other people as well, but it felt like it was for us.
Well, but it's interesting you would have been talking about it that recently, because the movie, as I mentioned, was from 1998, and the two of you are talking about this, and lo and behold.
We watch it at least once a year, probably more. So it's a regular event in our lives.
Well, let me tell listeners who you are. Troy Jollimore received his BA from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. His PhD is from Princeton University. He is a successful poet, and his essays and book reviews have appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times, and the Chicago Tribune. His philosophical articles have appeared in journals, including the Canadian Journal of Philosophy, and in collections, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and Bioethics and the Movies. So there's your interest in the movies, Troy Jollimore.
I seem to keep coming back to them. I honestly think, and this goes back to, I think, what Peter was saying about pop culture as a philosophical hook for Americans, but I think the movies are where we do a lot of our thinking in this country. And I think in the last few years in particular, there's been really amazingly sophisticated and philosophically interesting offerings in movie theaters.
Well, and I used to be an academic advisor years ago in the 70s, in fact, and an 18-year-old coming to campus, and this was a big university, but philosophy was a hard sell. I mean, I couldn't – it was not very easy to get them interested in philosophy, no matter how important I felt the subject was. And so do you find that if you can make these references that students' eyes light up?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, one of the things in my experience, was, you know, I teach at a liberal arts college, and it's there's always this rough transition you make, because when you're in grad school, you're just immersed in the most, you know, abstruse kind of arcane, you know, professional work. And then all of a sudden you're thrown into these classrooms with 18 and 22 year olds and you're expected to kind of communicate, you know, with them. What I found, I guess I've been doing it, you know, for 22 years or so now. And, it was an education for me. At first it was just an instrument to, as Troy said, to hook them and bring them in to think about this. But then you realize that actually, you know, film has become a way of thinking, you know, and it really has serious dimensions to it, even silly films. Our favorite philosopher is there's this guy named Ludwig Wittgenstein in the early 20th century. And he used to love also, you know, kind of cheesy, cheap American movies. But, you know, it's surprising we can find there. I mean, in a way, one of the great things, as I was saying in the introduction about philosophy, is that you find philosophical issues all across life. You can't avoid them, really, in life. But film has become, in our culture, I think, a way of trying to think through a lot of philosophical issues.
My guests are Peter Fossil, a professor of philosophy, Robert Jones, a professor of philosophy, and Troy Jollimore, also a professor of philosophy. And I mentioned the credentials. You guys are serious philosophers. And yet I was surprised that, and you knew this, I'm sure, that Ethan Coen, one of the writers of the movie, has a degree in philosophy.
That's right. From Troy.
Fellow Princeton man.
That's right.
So I don't know. All of them. That people who are fans of the Coen brothers' movies actually know that about him.
Yeah, and so it's not surprising that you'll find philosophical ideas in there, since he does have philosophical training.
Well, for the people who have not seen this movie, or maybe they hadn't seen it since 1998, what is the story? And who would like to tell us what the story is?
There's no quick answer. It's, in fact, an extremely complicated story, especially the first time through. One of the interesting things about this film, and one of the reasons why it didn't do well at the box office and then has this cult status, is that I think all of us had the same experience. I certainly did. That the first time through, it was okay. I enjoyed it. It was kind of a letdown after Fargo, which had been a real masterpiece. And there were things I laughed at, but there was a lot I couldn't quite follow or didn't quite get what they were getting at. And part of that is the complexity of the plot, which eventually turns out to be quite a simple plot, but the way it's revealed, you know, they really – it's a parody of a lot of Raymond Chandler in particular, of American film noir writers.
In fact, so, even the name, The Big Lebowski?
Yes, is from The Big Sleep. But right, so it takes something quite serious sounding and makes it ridiculous. And the basic idea of the film was to take a character, the dude played by Jeff Bridges, an aging ex-hippie stoner, the last person you would expect to find as a central role, at least in a Raymond Chandler film, and put him at the center of one of these type of films or novels, surrounded by all sorts of freaky characters of various sorts. It's that clashing of milieus that the Coens are so often interested in. And so he gets injected. He becomes kind of, without meaning to, a reluctant private eye and gets injected into this kidnapping plot. He has almost nothing to do with it, and suddenly he's at the center of it. And the movie is essentially his efforts to deal with this and then figure out what is going on. So it's epistemological, among other things. It's about knowledge, right? It's about how we understand and how we pursue knowledge. And there are many levels of complexity, but it's also a tour of Los Angeles. He travels around L.A. and meets all sorts of different people in different parts of L.A., which is what would happen in a lot of Raymond Chandler novels as well. It's a large part of the pleasure of those books is just simply taking that tour of this very strange, very comic, darkly comic and kind of surreal landscape that the Coen brothers, who love to get into a genre and kind of mess around with it, really wanted to play with in their book, in this movie, I mean.
Now, Professor Fossil, when you were reading your introduction, you mentioned bowling.
Hmm.
And Robert, you want to tell us about the role bowling has in the movie?
Yeah, bowling in a lot of ways is central to the film because it ties together. another reference to the film.
That, for people who have not seen the movie, they don't appreciate the fact that part of the plot is that somebody steals the dude's rug. And it's such a shame because it tied the room together.
Tied the room together. So in many ways, the bowling acts literally and metaphorically to tie the characters together. And
it ties the book together. The book that you guys have written and contributed to is set up like a bowling match.
That's right.
Yeah. The motif of bowling just appears. And throughout some of the essays focus on the bowling aspects. But at... You know, the bowling alley acts as sort of a home, a safe meeting place for the three central characters. It acts as, you know, there's issues of the repetition of bowling, the kinds of one of the essays makes reference to the Sisyphus.
It's mine, in fact.
Peter's essay.
Peter Fossil is, all, in addition to being the editor of this collection, is also a contributor. So he recognized the reference to his essay.
But,
and
yeah,
Professor Jones, you were saying.
Oh no, but yeah. So it plays a central role, and it's the bowling alley for the characters. It represents and the act of bowling it represents a kind of. A way for them to have some kind of stability, because there's just crazy stuff going on throughout the film, and bowling is sort of referenced as, it's almost like, let's go home, let's go to the safe place, let's go to the bowling alley. And at the bowling alley is where we see a lot of the conversations where the characters reveal their kind of inner thoughts and what's going on with the plot. So plays that kind of central role.
It's like their family. None of these guys have families, basically, independently, and so the three guys who bowl together, the dude, his friend Walter, and then the third character named Donnie, who turns out to be important in interesting ways. They form a kind of a family in lieu of the natural family that, for whatever reason, they don't seem to have.
And like a family, they don't see eye to eye philosophically.
Yeah.
This is Peter Fossil.
I'm sorry. Bowling has that function of bringing them together, but it pulls a number of the philosophical themes to a central place too. And one of the adversaries that the dude faces, and I won't get too much into the minutia of this, but are these this group of nihilists, and nihilism is a kind of philosophical problem or a philosophical movement that people have struggled with for 100 years now, and. That they appear in the film, clearly, I think, points to some of the philosophical purposes of the film. And in the bowling alley, there's a place where they can create a kind of, insulation from this. They have solidarity, they achieve friendship, they engage in conversation. And I think, in fact, that there's a kind of analogy to, Robert was saying, Sisyphus and the rolling of rocks up hills over and over and over and over in a way that still creates meaning in a threateningly meaningless universe. And so, bowling has a very serious philosophical dimension to it in the film, too.
Remind listeners that we're talking about the book, The Big Lebowski and Philosophy, Keeping Your Mind Limber with Abiding Wisdom. And my guests are two contributors to an essay to the book, Professor Troy Jollimore, Professor Robert Jones, and the editor and a contributor, Peter Fossil. And in the title is Abiding Wisdom. So what is this abiding about?
That's the deepest question of all.
That's the big question, isn't it?
Both the keeping your mind limber and the abiding wisdom, or abide in particular, are movie references. There is a moment very close to the end of the film, sort of the final pronouncement on the main character, the dude. Comes from a character identified only as the stranger, who sort of pops up as a meta-narrator, just a comment occasionally.
It's the name of a Camusian book, by the way.
Of course, that's right. So it's the existentialist references are legion in this film. But the stranger says of the dude abides. And he says, there's this great comfort in that. We take comfort in the fact that he does. What does that mean? Abide turns out to be a very complex word. And always with the Coen brothers, and this is true with all their films, not just this one, they are difficult to interpret in part because we don't know when they have a hidden meaning that we are supposed to decipher and when they are just sort of playing with us. And I think there's elements of both of that here with that abiding. They are getting at something serious, and yet they're also being kind of playful. The way the stranger talks, almost all the characters in this film talk in very odd ways, and the Coen brothers take such pleasure in people's language and the stranger's monologues. He introduces the film, he takes it out. They're really very wonderful. One of the reasons that this film has become so popular is it's so quotable, and you keep meeting people who quote. Some people memorize the entire film, and they'll just drop allusions into their conversation, and it's
in fact,
incredible.
I began to wonder. I felt like almost memorized the script because I remembered any reference that anybody makes. I remember that line. I remember the scene, and these lines are just like you said. They're unforgettable.
Yeah, they're excellent writers that way, and in this one, maybe more than any of their other films, though they do that a lot. But yeah, there's been a lot of philosophical ink shed over the question of the dude's abiding and exactly what that means.
Yeah, it seems to be his answer to nihilism. So if you can unpack Abiding, you've unpacked the movie in a way. And the limber part was, there's just a scene where he's with his girlfriend or sort of, liaison.
Special lady friend.
Thank you. As he calls her, Maud Lebowski. And you see in the scene, by the way, that there's Sartre's Being in Nothingness is on his bed table or stand next to his bed. And he says he's working on this case and he's been keeping his mind limber, in this case with a very strict drug regimen. But we sort of lifted it from that to a philosophical regimen.
Well, you know what? I was just thinking, in the title is The Big Lebowski, and I don't think we've clarified who the Big Lebowski is. We've talked about the main character, the dude.
Yeah.
And in fact, when this movie came out, there's a physician here in town whose name is Jeff Lebowski. And
really?
He told his friends that the movie was about him. And they believed him. But that was Dr. Jeff Lebowski.
Uh-huh.
And this book, Who is the Big Lebowski?
Well, that's a very good question because, I mean, there are a number of Lebowskis in the film. I think we could count four maybe. I mean, there's Jeff Lebowski, the dude. And then there's Mr. Jeff Lebowski, the millionaire. And there's Maud Lebowski, his daughter, the millionaire's daughter. Actually, there's five. There's Bunny Lebowski, the millionaire's wife. And by the end, there's another Lebowski, little Lebowski on the way. Maud becomes pregnant by the dude, and we might count that as the fifth. So which is the big, or is it's anybody's guess if it's an individual, or if maybe it's the big message of the movie. What do you think? What do you guys think?
It's a great question. I mean, we should perhaps point out that the ridiculous plot of this film is essentially set in motion as a result of the fact that two characters have the same name. The dude and the Big Lebowski are both named Jeff Lebowski. There is a mix-up, a confusion. And, of course, the two couldn't
Not to be confused with Jeff Lebowski.
Exactly. That's right. I mean, he's lucky he didn't get drawn into this too, obviously. But the two characters could not be less alike. And that the Coens, again, are clearly trying to say something interesting with that. So.
You want to go ahead and say what
well,
it is?
I can't exactly summarize, but there is something about the parallels between the different characters and the ways in which they're separate and the same. The Big Lebowski is revealed by the end of the film to be in some ways more like Jeff Lebowski, the dude, than he initially wants to let on.
And when you refer to Big Lebowski.
I mean the rich, the wealthy, successful Lebowski, right.
Just to clarify, I think –
This is Robert Jones, by the way.
Most fans of the film refer to the millionaire as the Big Lebowski. But as Peter and Troy have pointed out, it's not clear exactly what the title means. But the reference – some people make the mistake and refer to the dude as Lebowski. But
He doesn't like to be referred to that way. And in fact, it's an interesting fact about the film that so many of the characters are very concerned with what they're called and go on at some time about their names, what the proper way to address them, and with their image as well. It's one of the things we write about in our paper. The Big Lebowski, the successful, wealthy man in particular, wants to project a certain image to the world.
Well, I think some of the contrast.
This is Peter Fossil.
That Droy's pointing to is it has to do with I think post Vietnam America. You know, one of them's a Vietnam vet. Another was a peacenicky hippie. And there's a sort of Reagan-esque, entrepreneur millionaire, and the clash among them. I think is about us working out the clashes that have happened in our country since then, and so the Big Lebowski might be the big struggle. That's happened in the wake of Vietnam, which keeps on popping up in the film.
Mm-hmm. And the character, in case people saw the movie or wondered, the actor, John Goodman, is the one who plays the Vietnam vet. Mm-hmm. And what is his solution to everything that comes up?
He likes to take action. He's kind of a violent guy. He likes his weapons. Treats life as if he were still in Vietnam in a lot of ways, as if it had never ended, and tends to see things as crises into which he leaps with his gun at his side, usually making things worse rather than better. For me, one of the great aspects of this film, and in my philosophical work, I've written a lot about love and friendship. The friendship between the dude and Walter is very moving. As ridiculous a character as Walter is, There's something very touching at the end of it. And at the end,
there's
a funeral essentially, and they embrace each other. And you've come to realize how ridiculous Walter is, and thus to admire the dude's ability to accept him as he is, which is what in some way love is all about.
And for this friendship to endure.
He's seen to the bottom of Walter. He knows him at his worst. We've seen him get very frustrated with him, very angry with him. He's been very human with him. But he never really turns away, and he's always there. And there's something very touching, I think, in what at first seems a very silly movie, which some people have sort of written off as a silly movie. I think there's a really moving human relationship.
Well, and you can read, I think, a political or ethical, as Peter Fossil can, ethical point of that, because here's this, very opposite sides of America, the violent Vietnam vet and the peacenicky hippie, and they are able to resist the threats of nihilism and the corruptions of money from Mr. Lebowski and maintain, a union, maintain a community, maintain friendship and civility despite, what could be a kind of rending, divisive, fracturing, differences.
So we see all these contrasts between the lazy dude and the entrepreneurial or the the wealthy Lebowski is a high achiever, which uh-huh. turned out to be not to be the case. What are some of these other contrasts the Coen brothers have set up in this movie?
Well, I mean, those are some of the principal ones that you've articulated there. I think one of the things that gets exposed is that the dude is accused at first by being a worthless bum in the beginning by Mr. Lebowski, but what we find in the end is that actually the dude is this,
principled, centering,
humane force of goodness, whereas the guy accused him of being a bum is the real bum and is really guilty of everything he accuses the dude of being. And so this inversion happens there. There's an opposite of two kinds of women, too. I mean, the movie is set, although it's very male-centric, and I think it's rightly criticized for that. And we do have an article, though, an essay about the film. The dude as a feminist ally, which I was so pleased to get, because the film is in a way set in motion by a female transgression, by Bunny's transgressing against her husband, Mr. Lebowski's authority, about his control, about the sexual norms of the society in which she lives. And that sets it all in motion. And in some ways, too, another contrasting female, Maud Lebowski, is revealed to be really the center of that family, of the wealthy family, not the patriarch, but this strong, creative woman. So there's a background of women contrasting in there as well.
So what people should do is buy a copy of your book, take it with them to – now, there's such a thing as Lebowski Fest.
Yeah, many of them.
Take it with them to that. Watch the movie again and see all these wonderful lines that recur, but also see the philosophy behind it.
That's
what your book is a guide to enjoying philosophy.
Yeah, I could say if you go to LebowskiFest.org online, I mean, they're all over the world now. It's amazing how these are proliferating.
Thank you, gentlemen. We've been talking about The Big Lebowski and philosophy, keeping your mind limber with abiding wisdom. And my guests have been Peter Fossil, the editor and contributor to the book, and Robert Jones and Troy Jollimore, also contributors to the book. Thank you, gentlemen. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.